If one were to issue in this university community an invitation to meet with a distinguished columnist, and particularly a distinguished political columnist, you would have a substantial audience. If, however, you were to add that the occasion was to honor David Broder, you would then have the kind of audience which, in fact, we do have this afternoon. It is peculiarly appropriate that we gather for this purpose in Mr. Jefferson's rotunda. Had Mr. Jefferson lived another decade, I suspect in some way he would have become, if he was not already, an observer of the political scene of which he was himself so much a part. And among the legacy, or many legacies, which Mr. Jefferson left, that relationship between the world of media, which in his time meant newspapers and magazines, and the world of public service or politics, that connection was a vital part of Mr. Jefferson's own interest. The emphasis which he placed on the importance of understanding by the citizenry of the political process and public life certainly ranks high among the factors which draw a group of this kind together. Now, my purpose is simply in extending a welcome on behalf of the university, and then to ask Ken Thompson most appropriately if he would describe the award, say more about our honoree, and then I guess he and I together have the honor of making the presentation. So let me introduce the director of the center, our colleague Ken Thompson, for the honors.
President O'Neill, David and Ann Broder, ladies and gentlemen, I'll go directly to the citation. Most of you have been present at the relatively few previous events in which we have awarded the Burkitt Miller Prize to a person who, in the opinion of the Governing Council of the Miller Center, had contributed most to the understanding, improvement, and development of the presidency. The citation reads as follows. Charles McDowell commented that in more than 30 years of president watching and following the electoral process, he had never read more powerful and objective political commentary than David Broder's last few years of presidential analysis. Evidently, the wider community of journalists shares McDowell's view, for recently they selected Mr. Broder for the highly prestigious Fourth Estate Award. Earlier, he was the recipient of the Pulitzer Prize for distinguished commentary. In a little more than a decade, he has moved quietly to the forefront of his profession. He has served as leader of the celebrated and sometimes riotous Gridiron Club, at which presidents and congressional leaders are roasted and taunted and then respond to their tormentors. As national political correspondent, syndicated in more than 300 newspapers, and as associate editor of the Washington Post, he provides current political education for leaders by the thousands and for the citizenry in the millions. Accountability is the hallmark of David Broder's vision of public affairs, linked inseparably with a credo of responsibility for those who are its interpreters. Presidents are accountable to the people by whom they are elected. Therefore, they must be willing and able, periodically, to present themselves and their policies for public scrutiny at press conferences and in public discourse. Observers who are privileged to report and criticize on behalf of the public in a rough approximation of the British question period must practice the highest standards of detachment and objectivity. Theirs, no less than the president's, is a sacred trust. Yet Broder warns of certain tendencies that could be leading to an erosion of these noble precepts, including the migration of political partisans from government to journalism and back to government. Whereas ins and outers have throughout the 20th century moved from government to the tranquility of the academy and back to public service, today's ins and outers remain essentially on the firing line in what my colleague James Sterling Young has called the Washington Academy, think tanks and ideological pulpits that are holding patterns for activists awaiting a change in the political winds. In this setting, political weaponry is stockpiled and brandished in ongoing political warfare, sometimes at the expense of objective journalism. By contrast, David Broder's research methodology is clear. He travels the length and breadth of the land seeking to uncover truth from fiction in the never-ending political drama. Ringing doorbells and taping interviews far from the beltway is his stock and trade. He records his informant's views with precision and in hard print. Ask any subject who has been interviewed. He helps us understand the forces at work on the political scene, which determine the success and failure of presidents. But his more lasting contribution may be an emerging public philosophy, the broad outlines of which are becoming apparent. In the tradition of Walter Lippmann, whom Broder describes as, quote, the greatest American journalist in this century, he continues in virtually every book and column to craft and perfect a framework of thought to guide hard-pressed leaders and citizens seeking to find their way. In Changing of the Guard, published in 1980, he illuminated the presidential transition process. Earlier than many full-time scholars, he assessed the changing and diminished role of the political party in the parties over. In 1967, he co-authored The Republican Establishment. We go to school with him weekly, if not daily, on television programs such as The Today Show, Meet the Press, and Washington Week in Review. In the mold of Walter Lippmann, he has become the mentor of statesmen and scholars who seek to reconcile enduring principles with unending change. It remains as true today as in Lincoln's time that without a vision, the nation perishes. However, that vision must be quarried from the hard rock of political reason and experience, two ingredients that are always present in the works of David Broder. It is entirely appropriate, then, that he should receive the annual Burkitt Miller Award for his contribution to the understanding of the presidency and public affairs, and for the promise of his writings and commentary essential for a free and informed people.
President O'Neill, my old friend Ken Thompson, ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pride and humility that I accept this award. Following once again in Charlie McDowell's footsteps, I have trudged after him through a lot of places, but never one as classy as this, and I am very glad to be in his footsteps. Ann and I have lived in Virginia now longer than any other place we have been in our lives, and if we're very fortunate, we will finish up our lives here in Virginia. We have come to love and respect this state, and the recognition from the Miller Center and the University of Virginia is certainly one that I will cherish. I puzzled for some time because Ken did not give me specific instructions as to what I was supposed to talk about here, as to what ought to be the topic of these comments. And we can talk about the things that are in the news when we get to the question period, the budget or John Tower or Gorbachev or whatever you would like. to do. But it seemed to me that I should probably try to frame some sort of proposition that might have broader ramifications or applications and longer pertinence than the average newspaper column here. We're not talking about a message for the ages, let me assure you, but maybe something that might be still worth chewing on, say, 15 or 20 minutes after it's after it's finished. Journalism does not set terribly high standards for its for itself. And while there was no collusion between what Ken said and what I'm about to say, I have to say that the notion that did strike me as being one that does come up periodically in my work is that notion of accountability. How we behave and how we fashion our institutions in a way that allows the people who are supposed to be served to fix responsibility on those who are supposed to be serving them. I did manage to stir up a little bit of an argument in my own business with some remarks that I made late last year about what I thought was the decline or problems of accountability in journalism. I suggested in that talk that we in the press ought to take some responsibility for the integrity of our own press credentials by insisting that there is a clear and important distinction between those who are essentially journalists writing and commenting on public affairs and those who are essentially politicians or polemicists masquerading from time to time as journalists. I talked about the dangers to our business from those who have one foot on both sides of the line. The androgynous Washington insiders, as television likes to call them, who consult with the public through columns or television commentaries. At the same time, they consult with their political friends or their political clients for the sake of power and or profit. Well, it turned out that that concept of responsibility and accountability was more controversial in journalism than you would have imagined. Any number of people took umbrage at the notion that jumping back and forth across the line was somehow a problem. People from all kinds of ideology, from Bill Moyers and Hodding Carter to John McLaughlin and Pat Buchanan. But for all their rage, it still strikes me that the issue is clear. The more the lines of distinction between the press and politics are blurred, the greater the disservice to both those professions and to the society that they are supposed to serve. The reason is that we have two utterly different and in some ways contradictory systems of accountability in journalism and in politics. The accountability of politicians, clearly, and those the people that they appoint to a point of office, is clearly enforced by the election process. It's the ballot box that makes them accountable. They can be removed for office at the wish of the majority, and those that they offend or misrepresent have the power in any election to send them back to private life. Quite the opposite is the case for those of us in the press. When some offended viewer asked Dan Rather, "Who the hell ever elected you to anything?" The answer is no one. In a sense, we're supposed, all of us in journalism, subject to the tyranny of the counting house, my employer, the Washington Post, and my clients, the papers that publish my column outside Washington, can dump me anytime they wish. But the public cannot censor me or directly shut me down. The First Amendment offers that kind of protection to the semi-illiterate and the often uninformed people like myself, at the same protection as it does to scholarly gentlemen like Ken Thompson. What really holds me accountable in my daily work are the standards of journalism, such as they are, the requirement for balance and fairness in reporting and writing a news story, the responsibility to avoid willful distortion of reality, even in an opinion piece, a column, or an editorial. The reason that we should attempt to defend the integrity of our press credentials and not let them be taken whenever convenient by people who are essentially political activists is that the standards by which journalists are held accountable are the standards that one learns in the newsroom. They are inculcated by our mentors in the news organizations that we go to work for, and they are enforced by our peers, whose judgment is more important to us than anything else in our professional lives. And those who have not had that mentoring, those who do not regard themselves as peers of reporters, but rather as confidants and advisors and social partners of the politicians in power or seeking power, cannot be expected to respect, let alone enforce, the standards by which we are held accountable. Let me switch topics and give you one other example of the problem of accountability and responsibility. This one not drawn from the world of journalism, but of politics. As I said a moment ago, in politics, the accountability mechanism is clearly the requirement of election. But if the election process fails to present or define choices, then it is difficult to see how accountability can work in the political arena in other than just simply a formal or ritualistic sense. Well, you say, how could there be elections which don't present real choices? We're familiar with the Soviet model, where the voters were given a single slate in the pre-Gorbachev era and the opportunity to vote yes for the candidates who'd been handpicked. It was, as the saying goes, an offer those voters could not refuse. Well, I think increasingly our elections for the House of Representatives are approaching the level of predetermination that we are familiar with from the old Soviet model. In 1986 and 1988, more than 98% of the incumbents in both parties who chose to seek re-election were successful. As a result of this extraordinary incumbent success rate, the Democrats have maintained control of the House of Representatives for more than 36 years. And in all of the upheavals in that almost two-generation period, I think the figure is actually 34 years. I think I misspoke there. In all the upheavals of that almost two-generation period, the one constant in American government has been the party control of the legislative chamber that was originally designed to reflect and quickly measure and respond to even slight changes in the public mood and opinion. Does one conclude from that that there have been no mood shifts? We know far better. The White House has shifted parties four times in that period of Democratic hegemony in the House of Representatives. There have been eight different occupants of the White House during that period of time. No, what we know is that the House incumbents have effectively insulated themselves against challenge, have thwarted the accountability mechanism by equipping themselves with advantages that they systematically deny to their challengers. They give themselves large staffs, many district offices. Indeed, those offices are almost as ubiquitous as local insurance agencies, and the people in them are as eager to be of service as any good insurance man would be. In dealing with a distant and intractable home office policy or bureaucracy. It's very much that kind of local service agency the congressmen run. Direct mail paid for at public expense, radio and television messages financed by a system of what you could only call gentle extortion from the interest group PACs, which are bringing legislative business before the members' committees. And meantime, the incumbents have denied any public funds to their challengers and made it as difficult as possible for those challengers to raise funds from private contributors or political parties. As a result, most congressional challengers today are as nearly anonymous at the end of their campaigns as they were at the beginning, and an unknown person cannot be considered a genuine alternative to the incumbent member of the House. It's a near-perfect system of political self-perpetuation that they have developed, and in my view, an offense against the constitutional system of accountability. But if anything, the presidential elections are worse, because the presidential election process in our time increasingly fails either to present a choice or to define the choices for the country. Now, obviously, when you reach the presidential level, there are alternative candidates, and they are both well known by election day. But what the voters know of these candidates is almost entirely now what the candidates choose to let them know. We know, for example, that Michael Dukakis permitted a prisoner named Willie Horton to be furloughed, and that he failed to clean up the sludge in Boston Harbor. We know those two things not because they're the most important or most relevant things to know about Michael Dukakis, but because the George Bush campaign spent literally millions of dollars to be sure that those two facts were known by everybody who might vote in that election. The point is not a partisan one. The fact is that communication in the presidential general election is increasingly controlled by the campaigns themselves, in part through advertising, and in part by providing very, very limited statements from the candidate that can be used in the sound bites, as they call them, on the evening television news. That sound bites are now controlled by the campaign almost to the same extent that the advertising is controlled by the campaign. A very high percentage of the information that a very large portion of the public receives in any presidential general election now is generated and controlled by the two candidates and their staffs. They define the choices in ways that suit their purposes, but may not suit the public's wishes. I believe from 1986 onward, on the basis of some of that door knocking that Ken Thompson has referred to, that the American public was ready and indeed eager to listen to ideas on how the United States could meet what most people now see as one of our major challenges, namely managing the competition in the international economic order in a way that improves our chances of maintaining what we have come to think of as an American standard of living. But that was a hard question for the candidates to wrestle with, and the answers might have involved deferral of consumption or pleasure. It might have involved even that terrible word T-A-X-E-S. So the candidates chose, for their own good reasons, to deal with simpler issues. And the winner of that election, in my view, has still not addressed the question that was uppermost on the voters' minds, and that they were ready and willing to see their leaders ask themselves and attempt to answer. The failure to define the choices is closely linked, I think, to the failure to present choices. The last campaign that settled much beyond the name of the fellow who got to listen to Hail to the Chief played in his honor was the campaign of 1980. In my view, Ronald Reagan could have won that 1980 election by saying simply five words, "I am not Jimmy Carter." He chose to say a great deal more than that. And the most significant thing that he chose to say was, "I come to this office with an agenda. I intend to reduce taxes across the board. I intend to shift resources on a massive scale from the domestic to the defense side of the budget. And I intend to do my utmost to slow down the growth of domestic government at the federal level in this country." And he said one other thing, which is very rare in this day and age of politics. He said, "If you want the kind of change that I'm talking about, then don't just vote to change presidents again. We do that a lot. If you believe in what I'm talking about, then vote for so-and-so for the United States Senate, vote for so-and-so for the House of Representatives, and we will work together to bring about that kind of change." The result of that 1980 campaign was that almost anybody who was reasonably attentive to politics understood from Ronald Reagan's own lips, in campaign ads and in speech after speech, what he intended to do if he became president. And the result of that was that we had a session of Congress in 1981 which is as close to parliamentary government as I've ever seen or ever expect to see in Washington, D.C., where the program on which the president and his colleagues had been elected was put into legislative form, was brought before the Congress, and was enacted into law all in the space of 8 months. Now, I happen to think that is very healthy kind of politics, not because I agreed with necessarily with every single change that Ronald Reagan made. I did not. But because it was clear that voting had consequences, that if you wanted to send an instruction to your government and see that instruction carried out, the act of voting was an effective way of doing that. We've had very different kind of politics since 1980. In the 1984 re-election campaign, the same Ronald Reagan's only statement of any sort of memorableness that was that wonderful line, "You ain't seen nothing yet." It meant two things. It meant that wonderful things would happen if he were re-elected, and it also meant you'd have to wait until after the election to find out what those wonderful things were going to be. It was a sort of a guessing game, and if anybody guessed in the 1984 campaign that the landmarks of the second Reagan administration would be a tax bill of the kind that we got in 1986, or an arms control agreement with the Soviet Union and the whole pattern of rapprochement with the Soviet Union, I would like to meet that individual, because he certainly saw things in that campaign which were not visible to me. In 1988, we saw more of the same pattern. Someone said that the only thing you could guess from the Bush campaign was that Willie Horton would not get a furlough if he came into the federal prison system, and that Boston Harbor would get some cleanup funds. Well, that turned out to be only half right, because the cleanup funds in the budget are not there for Boston Harbor, it turns out. The great game in Washington today, aside from the John Tower rumors, is guessing what's the agenda. We had a session with Governor Sununu over in my paper this morning for an hour, and most of the questions were exactly variations on that basic theme. You've been in office for 30 days now. What's the agenda? The question has to be asked because it was not answered and not even approached in the election campaign itself. What has happened to elections? Fundamentally, it seems to me that the custody and control has been transferred without protest from the people to the politician. In Mr. Jefferson's theory of democracy, the people were sovereign, and the election period was the time when they exercised their sovereignty. But we've evolved into a situation where the custody and control has been moved into the hands of the very politicians who are supposed to be awaiting the people's judgment in the court of public opinion. The politicians now control what evidence is placed in testimony, what questions are answered. They even monitor the jury's minds as guidance as to what they should or should not say in the courtroom of public opinion. The whole process has been turned utterly upside down. We hand these two candidates and their temporary campaign committees unconditionally something like $90 million of our tax money and say, go ahead and use it to propagandize us for your own purpose. No requirements, not a requirement that they debate with each other, no requirement that they speak to the major public concerns, no requirement that they answer questions from anyone, including the reporters during the campaign. Just simply as an opportunity for them to go ahead and use our money for their purposes in the way that they see it. And clearly their purpose is defined 99% in terms of the tactics that will maximize their chance of winning the office. In my view, that comes close to no public accountability in the process at all. Now, I was making a somewhat similar argument down at the University of Texas shortly after the election, and one of the professors stopped me cold by asking this question. What makes you think that the result would be any better or any different if you had the kind of campaign dialogue that you seem to think has been missing in recent campaigns? I said I could not be sure that the result would be all that much better, but I think there is evidence that the growing separation between elections and government is having negative effects. Elections by themselves are fascinating spectacles to the few of us political freaks who really either make our living out of it or somehow, like Larry Sabato, gets great enjoyment just out of sort of poking at them and seeing what makes them tick. Most people, most sane people, prefer other diversions, whether it's ACC basketball or Halloween 9 on the VCR. There are other things that they would rather do with their time. Most normal people participate in elections only when they think that those elections have some consequences which are real and which are important to them. As Dick Scammon liked to say back in the 1970s, you have a referendum on school busing in any affluent suburban community, and you have to use sticks to beat people away from the polls. They will find their way to the polls to vote if they think there is something really important at stake for them in that election. But in this last election, we've seen a continuation of the pattern of declining turnouts. Barely half the people bothered to vote in 1988. And when one candidate said the issue is competence and the other candidate said the issue is sort of your ability to read his lips, it's not surprising that that is the level of turnout that you get. But the people know, in a way that I think is far wiser and more profound than anything that those of us who are professionally engaged in this can formulate for them. The people know that to govern is to choose. And they know that if the choices are not made in the election, that doesn't mean that the choices will not be made. They will be made, and they will be made by another process. And I think the public suspicion is that they will be made in a much more closed system in which they, as individual citizens, have much more difficulty participating. They see government then becoming a game for the insiders. And I have to believe that in part that is why they turned on Congress with the wonderful enjoyment that they did on this pay raise question and said, you touch the nickel of that money and we're going to cut your hands off. Now, in the face of it, it makes no sense at all that people would reelect 98% of the Congress and then get so furious when that Congress said, we'd like to have a catch-up pay increase to catch up with inflation. Makes no sense at all, except if you consider the altered possibility, which I think is real, that the congressional election was not a real election in most voters' minds. It was an artifact controlled and contrived by the ability of those members of Congress, the incumbents in both parties, to deny real equality of opportunity to their challengers, and that the victory of the incumbent party, once again, in no way bespoke a genuine vote of confidence on the part of the public in that Congress. Well, I think I probably belabored the point more than I was necessary. I have a few notions, but only a few, about how we might get a greater degree of accountability into our political and journalistic system, but I may confess in advance there are no great conclusions that I have come here to suggest. I hope I have managed to communicate some of my concerns, along with my gratitude to all of you for this session. But perhaps it's time now for me to subject myself to that old-fashioned accountability mechanism called the question period, and I'd like to do that with your permission. Thank you very much. Yes.
You had commented, that you weren't all that thrilled about the idea of politicians controlling what evidence is put into the public forum. What do you have to say about the Oliver Moore situation where politicians are doing just that, putting it, choosing what evidence is to be revealed in that trial?
Question is about how does my concern about the politicians controlling the evidence apply to the Oliver North situation? I think it's a very different situation. I am not a lawyer, but I do think that when it comes to putting a person on trial on criminal charges, which Colonel North is now facing, that there is every reason for the judge to go at least as far as he has gone to protect that defendant's right to a fair trial. And if there is a conflict, if there is a genuine conflict between national security requirements of the government and the ability of Colonel North to make the best possible defense that he can make of his own actions, then it seems to me that conflict has to be resolved in a way that protects the colonel's rights. I'm not competent to judge what the degree of danger is if some of the evidence that he and his attorneys may want to present, how serious that threat really is to the national security. But it's an argument, it seems to me, that ought to be listened to with great respect, and I think the judge has given us every reason to believe that he will give great weight to that consideration. Yes.
Campaigners, the runners, can they really be blamed for any views that they think is going to get them elected? And wouldn't it be the journalist's responsibility to bring other issues people like that are taken with their district?
That's a very good question and a fair question. The question is, if it's true, as I tried to suggest, that a very high percentage of the information that people got about the choices in the last campaign came from and was controlled by the candidates themselves, can they be blamed for doing the things that would most enhance their chances of election? And what about the role of the press in bringing out the other information? Clearly, the candidates cannot be blamed at all. I mean, their objective is victory. And I think the whole notion that we should expect them altruistically to accept a higher standard of behavior for themselves is unrealistic. I mean, that takes us right back to the fundamental principles enunciated in the Federalist Papers, that a constitution is designed to deal with the human frailties that we know are there, not to deal with a government that it would be a government of angels. These candidates are not angels. They have a selfish, real, genuine purpose of their own to fulfill, which is securing the office of the presidency. But the system in which they operate, the process in which they operate, ought not, in my view, to indulge that wish entirely on their part. There ought to be some way of building some requirement of a public dialogue that is of use to the public in making the public's choice effective in that election campaign. Now, where does the press fit in? Clearly, we have a responsibility. But I have to tell you, just as a practical matter, the ability of the press to, quote, unquote, set the agenda in a general election campaign is minimal. There is very little effective that we can do to tell candidates what they must do in that setting. It is very hard to write stories about speeches that are not given. It is very hard to write stories about press conferences that are not held. And increasingly, the pattern in the presidential campaign is that the candidates choose to avoid substantive speeches and avoid frequent news conferences. They would much prefer to keep the information, the flow, one way, and to control that flow by making their public utterances scarce, not frequent. Now, what can we do? One of the things that I think we could do is what the commercial networks began to do right at the end of the last campaign, when they made large blocks of time available on primetime or late night news broadcasts, 10, 15 minutes for an interview with a candidate on the evening news, 90 minutes on Nightline. That's the kind of offer which a presidential candidate has great difficulty refusing, because the audiences are so large, and the refusal to accept the offer is itself becomes news with a negative implication about the candidate who declines the offer, that there is a kind of an element of compulsion, almost, if you make that kind of offer available to the candidate. If, for example, we could persuade the television networks, the commercial television networks, to take 10 minutes one night a week on their primetime news show and interview the presidential candidate or a designated spokesman on a particular area of policy. They did that once a week, each week from Labor Day to Election Day. By that very fact, you would change substantially, in my view, the character of the dialogue. In 10 minutes, you have to say something more than what you can suggest or imply in a 30-second spot. And if you're asked a question or two in that course of that 10 minutes, refusal to say more becomes in itself an obvious factor for the public to weigh there. It's a very, very useful device There are ways in which we can improve the quality of the dialogue. But to suggest that we in the press can somehow hold the candidates to a higher standard by themselves than they are prepared to take for themselves is, in most cases, unrealistic. Would you like to follow up?
One, wouldn't such a system be turning the election issues over to some of the candidates, the press, instead of what you want the people? And two, isn't that going against sort of an idealistic notion that the press is supposed to report the news instead of create the news that they would be doing?
Well,
the election issues over to some of the candidates, the press, instead of what you want the people? And two, isn't that going against sort of an idealistic notion that the press is supposed to report the news instead of create the news that they would be doing?
Well, the question is, doesn't that tend to shift the power to the press rather than to shift it to the people? And doesn't it get in the no way in the notion that the press is supposed to report the campaign rather than play an active role in it? I don't see any contradiction in our reporting the campaign and our using interview opportunities or creating interview opportunities for the candidates. It seems to me that the interview is a standard journalistic device. The only thing that's unusual about it is that you rarely get to interview the presidential candidates at the time that those interviews would probably be of the greatest interest and the greatest use, namely during the general election. As to whether it shifts the power to the press, to a certain degree, it clearly does. But it is difficult. It is difficult for 200 million people to engage directly in a dialogue with two. This is an improvisation, and it's an approximation of what that kind of direct dialogue would be. But it seems to me it's a step that might be useful to the 200 million people, rather than the repetition of simply the same advertising message over and over again. Yes, sir.
I'll follow that up.
Please.
I accept what you say, but it seems to me there is an area where the press could do a great deal more to be helpful in the campaign, and that is by way of examination of the candidate's previous records.
Mm-hmm.
As governors, senators, or whatever. Seems to me that we have had several good examples of a failure to give the public the kind of balanced and informative judgment that would have been immensely helpful.
Mm-hmm.
In weighing those candidates. Have you any thoughts as to what might be done there?
The observation, and it's a very important one, is that one thing the press could do more than it does and better than it does is to examine, evaluate, and report on the candidates' records, their history. And I agree with that very much. That is something that we have the capacity to do. It's something that we have developed formats for doing. I think it's being done better as in successive campaign cycles, but not as well yet as it needs to be done. At my paper, if I can be personal for just a moment, we've learned a couple things about those candidate profiles. One, that if you do the reporting early, before it is very clear that this person has at least a 50-50 chance of being the next president of the United States, folks who have known them, worked with them, seen them come up in their careers, whatever the career pattern has been, will in fact be very helpful to you in providing insights, anecdotes, examples on which you can base a report that would tend to give people a sense, this is how this person operates. This is how they deal with pressure. This is how they delegate or don't delegate. These have been their close associates. These are the recurring patterns in their behavior that are healthy or are troublesome to those who have known them over a long period of time. The earlier you do that reporting, the greater candor you're likely to get. The difficulty is, of course, in daily journalism, that when you report a story, you tend to write the story. And we were tending to write these stories often a full year ahead of Election Day, in the fall before the primaries began. Well, the number of people who were terribly interested at that point in, say, Michael Dukakis of Massachusetts is not that huge in a universe, particularly since, to use the fruits of this kind of reporting, generally takes some space in a newspaper. So we were sort of hung up on that question. And what we ended up doing in 1987-88 cycle was quite deliberately to do three separate cycles of candidates. We did the whole field in each party before the first primary. We came back and did the two prospective nominees again just before the convention at which each of them was going to be nominated. And then we did it, the two of them, again just before Election Day. Different reporters, but we turned over our notes to each other. And so you had some of the advantage of fresh insights, but you also kept the advantage of some of that early reporting being recycled through the second and third rounds of the thing. I think it was more useful that way, because clearly there are different audiences that are paying attention at different times. The best profiles I saw, I have to say, was one on television, on public television, on the Frontline program, that Gary Wills and a television producer named Sherry Jones did. It was a double profile. You saw it. Of George Bush and Michael Dukakis, extremely insightful, extraordinary interviews. There are people talking on camera who had known them at different points in their lives. I wish that program had been somehow, if there were a way to make a mandatory viewing for every voter, I would have had absolutely no qualms about the outcome of the election, because I thought this comes as close to depicting the strengths and the vulnerabilities of these two human beings, probably as journalism is capable of doing. Historians, psychiatrists, other people could probably bring in a whole other dimensions. But as journalists, that's about as good as work as we can do. It was repeated on public television, but the challenge, it seems to me, is somehow by 1992 to get the commercial networks, which have much larger audiences, to say, this is something that you really ought to undertake with your resources, your people. Give us an hour or two look at each of these people before we choose one of them to be president of the United States. Yes?
What was Governor's response to this story? Is it important?
His answer essentially was this. It's a simple agenda, relatively short. On the domestic side, it has two items: fix the budget, fix the savings and loan. Budget, as you know, includes a number of programmatic proposals from the president, and he expects there will be other programmatic proposals from Congress. On the foreign side, the current agenda is, let's evaluate where we are in U.S.-Soviet relations, in the Middle East, in Western Hemisphere, and in Far East. Once we've done that evaluation, which I think he said would take about 2 months more, then we will have some policy proposals and a strategy from which to operate. That's the agenda. Yes?
How do you respond to those critics who say that even with some sort of standard of accountability, there's a problem with journalists who move back and forth between the editorial page and news reporting, just as there may be between people who move between politics and journalism?
Good question. Is there not a conflict of interest for journalists who move back and forth between the editorial page and the news page, as there may be for those who move back and forth between politics and journalism? I think the answer is yes, there certainly is that kind of potential conflict. It's rare in our business that somebody gets to do what I do, which is to both write a column and do reporting. It was not sort of planned in my case. It sort of happened. And I have made a point of doing two things, because I do think there is that potential for problems clearly is there. at least once a year, I sit down with Ben Bradley and or Len Downey, our managing editor, and say, it's time to look at what's going on and for you to tell me sort of what kind of static you've been getting about this thing. Give me your sense of where we are on it. I also have been, I hope, sensitive to the potential conflict, and if sometimes, I guess the fancy word would be, recused myself from reporting on stories where I've written columns that I thought clearly indicated a bias or point of view on the person being written about. An example, I was considerably bothered by some of the things that I saw, thought I saw and heard in George Wallace's campaigns. And I wrote a column that particularly I remember one out of Indiana during the presidential primary there in 68, I guess. 68 or 64 now, I can't remember. And I remember going back to Washington after that and saying, you know, it's not fair to Wallace, it's not fair to the readers for pretending you can write that kind of column and then turn around and be a totally dispassionate, detached, objective observer of the Wallace campaign. Somebody else ought to be covering Wallace for us there. And we were able to make that kind of arrangement. But there really is a tension that's involved, and it's one that probably ought to be carefully monitored, and maybe it ought to, maybe this, the situation should not be allowed to exist. I would not, I mean, I'd have a hard time personally because I love reporting and I enjoy the freedom of having the column. But if the choice were made, I'd go back to being just a reporter without much hesitancy. But it's troubling. It is very troubling. Yes.
I think you're right that the public is feeling manipulated in elections. And you were mentioning that it should maybe demand more debates for its public. That's one of the instruments to size up the two candidates. It seems to me that even debates have gotten so stilted and without spontaneity. Do you see any way of improving that to, when a candidate doesn't, is so weak on a question that he just answers for specific question, that politeness should be swept aside and say, you're not answering my question?
Yes. The observation is made, and I think accurately, that debates, candidate debates, have become so stilted themselves that the candidates seem just to be feeding back sort of pre-rehearsed answers. Is there anything could be done about that? Yes, there's something could be done about that, which is to open up the format of the debate and make them something much closer to a debate. The reason that we have those sort of joint news conference stilted 2-minute answer, 1-minute response sort of things is that, again, the candidates and their managers feel that that is the way for them to do it most securely, so that even if they pretend or appear to be taking risk by going into the debate, the actual risk is small because they are maximally in control of the format. Now, how are they able to assert that degree of control? Because the underlying assumption is that it is up to the candidate to decide whether or not there are going to be debates. I think fundamentally we have to challenge that assumption that the candidates have an unlimited control and custody over what happens in the general election campaign. And we happily have some leverage for making that assertion, challenging them, because they are running with our money now. We give them the money for their campaign, and then they tell us what kind of a campaign they deign to put on. That doesn't seem logical to me. If we're paying for it, it seems to me we ought to be in a position to say, this is the kind of campaign that we're prepared to pay for. And these are the minimal sort of things that we can expect. I've made the same argument without any luck in my own business. I have said the publishers and news executives, broadcast news executives, who pay for all of us flying around the country with these candidates, ought to say to the candidates, look, it's your campaign. There are 168 hours in the week. You control 167 and a half of them. We want one half hour each week where the people that whose expenses we're paying can ask you some questions. Minimal sort of a demand. But if you can't find your way clear to finding a half hour a week for a news conference, then we're going to have to rethink whether it's worth the while our investing in paying for those people to fly from city to city and with you. It's often the case now, when you're covering, quote-unquote, a presidential candidate, that you can go all day without being within 200 yards of that candidate. Now, that seems to me sort of dumb on the part of the news industry. It seems to me it's sort of dumb on part of the public to say, gee, we're paying for this campaign, and now we please, please, like you to talk to us in ways that might help us really make up our minds between you. If we're paying for it, we ought to be in a position to say, these are the questions that we would like addressed. This is a format that we would find useful. I don't think I have yet to find any voter who is in love with this format. They ask the same question that you ask when you're going door to door. Why are all the reporters have to be up there? Why is there somebody who has to say, time's up, on to the next question? They think that we imposed that on the candidates. And you say, the candidates have taken that out as an insurance policy for themselves. They say, oh, well, we didn't realize that they wanted it that way. Yes? You're fading out on me. I didn't hear the last few. Paul, how do you see the role of the polls and what? I like polls. I use them a lot in reporting. I am a skeptic when it comes to the notion that in the general election, polls predetermine the outcome. I don't think there's substantial evidence that's the case. Polling, early polling, clearly can affect candidates' fundraising ability, and that is a mischievous consequence. But it strikes me as being almost a Luddite notion that somehow if we have this capacity to measure the current state of public opinion, that it's not going to be used or that it shouldn't be used. The difficulty is that there are too many of us in journalism who want to push the polls to do things that they cannot do. And the example that you cited of that dreadful ABC television presentation, which said this election is locked, was perhaps the worst example of 1988. I mean, that caused a major sort of rupture. We are partners of ABC News in a national polling operation. The Post and ABC News paid for that poll, but we presented the results in a very different way, and we were very unhappy to have our name associated with their presentation of the results as constituting a lock on the election, because there was plenty of evidence, even in that poll, that a significant number of people, easily enough to swing the outcome of the election, had a very, very light attachment to either of the candidates, and a significant number at that point didn't like either of the candidates very much. It was not a locked situation, it was a volatile situation. And to present it in the way that it was presented on that television network was, I thought, just A, unprofessional, and B, unconscionable. Yes?
Is there another factor in national elections that is 1980, Reagan found a note that, of course, great majority of people warmed up to, he got a response with this agenda you mentioned. Whereas that doesn't necessarily happen automatically every 4 years. And the lack of such a almost universal feeling, the split of views and so on may have the effect of causing the kind of campaign that you and others have criticized so severely, the one of 88.
I think that you make a very good point, that there certainly are times when either there may be no consensus in the country as to what area it wants to go and what the next step should be, or alternatively, there may be no desire in the country very much for any significant degree of change. Basically, the country says, things are all right, just don't let things get screwed up, and we'll be very happy with your presidency. That's about all we're asking of you. It's clear that there is not consensus in the country now as to what the steps ought to be, specific steps ought to be. But there are concerns in the country that are close to universal. I mentioned one earlier, namely, how are we of this generation going to turn over the country to the next generation in a condition where they will have the same degree of opportunity that we have all enjoyed? That is a concern which you hear totally across the political spectrum. And it is one which I think the American public would like to have addressed. Doesn't mean that they know the specific answers to it, but it is a challenge which they would like to believe their leaders are going to address in the next few years. Clearly, the plague of crime and drugs in this country is a challenge which the American people believe that their leaders ought to address. Now, beyond the sloganeering level, we didn't hear very much about that subject either. And if I'm wrong about believing that those two at least are on the national agenda, then I think there's an experiment that will prove that I'm wrong. If Mr. Bush fails to address those questions meaningfully in the next 2 years, I would guess that his popularity will begin to decline, that the number of people who say they are satisfied with his presidency will begin to slide off. The number of people who say in answer to another favorite polling question that the country is on the wrong path rather than headed on the right course, that number will begin to increase as time goes on. If, on the other hand, there really is no consensus for change, if there is no great national desire for anything particularly to be done in Washington, then I would think that Mr. Bush has great leeway to sort of go on as he's begun to do already, to sort of making the most minor fine-tuning changes in the budget and attempting to keep the economy for now on an even keel. And we'll see. I mean, that's a political theory. And I'm willing to be judged, you know, in terms of whether by the next 2 years as to whether that theory is right or wrong. Yes, sir.
Several times about the present nominating system versus the old smoke-filled rule.
Yes.
Is the present one all that much better than it used to be, and particularly in terms of the Democrat that we're elected
to? I think the present nominating system is a little cuckoo, but it's antic. It's a very strange way to choose a presidential candidate. On the other hand, I see no likelihood short term that system is going to be radically redesigned, in the sense that we're either going to reduce significantly the number of primaries or rationalize the primaries through some system, either of specifying dates with intervals between primaries or grouping the states in a way that made sense geographically or whatever time zone or whatever kind of grouping you want to contrive. I don't see that kind of change coming. I think the only thing that's in store now is probably some more state-by-state manipulation designed to enhance the position of that state or group of states in the present system. There's a likelihood, for example, that California may try to move its primary up to the beginning of the process to enhance California's voice in the presidential selection system, in theory. And as you know, the history of those contrived changes is that they tend to have unexpected and often undesired results. I think the Southern Regional Primary was a great disappointment to the sponsors of the primary, because the two people that did best on Southern Primary Day were Michael Dukakis and Jesse Jackson. I don't think that's what the Southern Democratic legislators who put that together had in mind when they were putting that, going through all the effort of getting that thing put together. So the law of unintended consequences may turn right around and bite California in the rear end if they go ahead with what they're going to do. But I just don't see the impulse at this point in the political system, nor do I see where we're going to create the leverage or get the leverage to affect any major change in that nominating system. I think you have the last one. Yes. I'm not sure that I can explain it, but I'm appalled by it. I mean, I am appalled by the response. It seemed to me that when that kind of threat is made against the citizen of a nation, the proper response is, if anything happens to our citizen, there will be the most serious consequences for the country that has made this threat. I don't regard that as blustering and so on. I think that kind of intimidation, that sort of threat of terrorism, assassination, is absolutely unacceptable in the modern world. And the only way you deal with that, it seems to me, is in the most straightforward way to say, if you strike against our citizen, prepare yourself because there will be a counter blow, and then carry out that policy. The notion that you pull the books off or hide the books or put the person into hiding to avoid that kind of threat is just really obnoxious to me. That is letting them jerk us around in a way that we absolutely cannot accept. Because it says you can end our freedom anytime you choose to make that sort of threat. Freedom, whether it's the freedom to publish a book, to purchase a book, freedom to move about as a private citizen, as Mr. Rushdie should have the perfect right to do. It seems to me the response has to be to go right back to the source of that threat and say, you touch him, you are in big trouble, because we're coming after you. Thank you very much.
Beginning with Duma Malone, we've had enlightening and educational responses to the Birkett Miller Award, but to those of you who have missed some of those responses, I think one can honestly say we've never had one that was so generous and full of thoughtful analysis and discussion. We're terribly grateful to David Broder for giving us a full day in this way.
Thank you.